even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to A Word with Tom Merritt. I'm Tom Merritt, and on this show, I have the pleasure and privilege to sit down with some of the smartest, most interesting people in the world and talk about how we think. Because there is no way all of us can know every single thing. So how we make our shortcuts that get us through life is very important. It's always good to compare notes on how we do that. These are the kinds of conversations that are my favorite. I've had them all my life with my grandpa Carl in his front room, my grandma Roxy in her front room. I got lots of different ways of looking at the world, great conversations, and it was all leading me up to this moment right now. Welcome into the front room, Natalia Antalava.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
So, Natalia, would you describe yourself as a journalist?
Yes, I hope so. Still, yes.
Some journalists don't, so I'm always careful.
Much describe myself as a journalist.
Yeah. And you've had an interesting journey. You've worked for major publications, major networks, and you've struck out on your own. Can you give us sort of the summary version of your journey?
Sure. I guess I should start by saying that I come from Georgia, but the other Georgia, the country, not the state. And I was born in a country that no longer exists, which was the Soviet Union, but I caught the tail end of it. Always knew that I wanted to be a journalist and ended up sort of maneuvering my way into the BBC and found myself at age sort of 19 in West Africa, freelancing for BBC African Service. And then, it kind of snowballed from that. One assignment led to another, I just about managed to finish university. And I just dived straight into reporting and into work and ended up having this, incredible career with the BBC. Well, living and working in all sorts of places, finding myself in the jungle in Burma one day, in Tehran, and the next having tea with Hezbollah or, meeting presidents of some of the world's most reclusive regimes. It was really, really fun. Until one day, like so many of us, I guess, I woke up and thought to myself, is there any point to what I do in life? And how can we do it better? So I started trying to figure out what were the weak points of journalism and where it was that we failed. And I, basically built from my own frustrations at the time, because it did feel like, I was just constantly adding to all of the noise that was happening around us instead of, just the news machine all of a sudden seemed like this like noisy thing that was just generating loads and loads of noise,
and it
was no longer
it, right.
And the internet absolutely fueled it. The space, this infinite space for constant updates, the insatiable appetite, the bottomless pit, and all of us just throwing all this information out there. So what really drove me to leave the mainstream media and set up on my own, not on my own, I have a co-founder at Coda Story, but what really drove me personally was a quest for, the question of like, how do we actually bring context and continuity to coverage of these major issues? Because so many times when you're on the receiving end of a newscast, you feel like things have just come out of the blue, but nothing ever comes out of the blue, right? That there is context to everything. So how can we as journalists bring that context in our stories, but also in the process of creating journalism? And how do we create a newsroom that really works to bring, to connect those dots, to bring the context and continuity to these big stories? So that's what we wanted to figure out. Myself and a friend turned co-founder turned business partner, still a friend. And that's the journey we started on about 6 years ago now. And that's how Coda Story, the nonprofit newsroom that we run, that's how it kind of was born into the world.
One of the things that you shed light on, among many, many things that you shed light on there, is the ability to suss out what is valid information and what is not, what is useful information and what is not. It's something that I think especially people who aren't growing up with the massive use of the internet post-smartphone struggle with. We used to have a couple of sources, maybe a daily newspaper, you know, maybe a couple of national networks. So it was easy to see where the news was coming from. That didn't mean that it was always reliable either, but at least you had fewer sources to try to keep track of. Now you have endless sources of information, which is why I wanted our word to be manipulation. What does that word mean to you?
It means what the powerful do to those who have less power. And that applies to everyone. That probably applies to me and you. It applies to children. Those of us who have children know how well they can manipulate the powers that they have over their parents and vice versa. And it applies on big sort of scale to governments, you know, geopolitics, obviously, as well. So it's everywhere. And the digital space, the digital era has definitely changed the nature of manipulation. It's given power. I think it's given power to more people at the start. And then I think those who have held power traditionally have managed to get a lot of it back and suddenly ended up with more power than to manipulate they've ever had before. You know, and right now I'm thinking about troll farms and, mm-hmm. you know, the mass manipulation of the public opinion that we're seeing across the board in all countries and so on. So I think manipulation is part of life. It always has been, but it takes new shapes and forms in the digital age. And I think it's important to be aware of them.
Yeah, manipulation at scale, so to speak.
Where, that's
you
right.
know, it's different when your child is manipulating you to get something they want versus the entire, you know, troll farm times 10 out there spraying information around the internet, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. And I think, of course, the most powerful sort of manipulation is the kind that happens when you don't even realize that it's happening and the way that your opinions are shaped and the way your worldview is shaped without fully realizing that it is being manipulated to someone else's benefit. And I think that we are seeing newer forms of that sort of manipulation than we've ever seen before.
It is interesting, and you kind of touched on this a minute ago, that more people than ever have more power to manipulate, and yet we still find it being centralized. What do you think has allowed that? The early hope of the internet was that decentralization would prevent that from happening.
I think partially we got the internet wrong. And I think in getting internet wrong, we somewhat maybe got the human nature wrong as well. Maybe we were more idealistic about it than we should have been. Maybe I should just be saying that about myself, but that's certainly what I think. You know, I definitely remember the time when, you know, tech held the promise of more freedom, more openness, kind of a brighter future, a place where, you know, everything was possible. And actually the time when I started thinking of sort of leaving mainstream journalism and my reporting career and doing things differently was the time around the Arab Spring, the string of popular uprisings and revolutions that really starting from Tunisia and then on, you know, and so then I spent a lot of time in Yemen at the time covering the Arab Spring in the Yemen Spring, you know, mm-hmm. the uprising there. And, you know, there was a tremendous sense of hope and social media and internet in general, but social media in particular played an enormous role in creating that hope and giving people that hope and mobilizing them and allowing them to sort of find a new voice in political systems that were run by dictators for decades and decades. And it felt truly revolutionary and it felt like a beginning of a new era. Except I think the dictators woke up to it pretty quickly. And I think, you know, they came to their senses. And ever since then, you know, if we just launched a new podcast, which is called Tech Tyrants and Us, in which we explore this very question. We basically went around the world kind of trying to figure out, is tech ultimately serving democracies or dictators? You know, whose side is tech on? You know, obviously the argument goes tech is on no one's side, but I'm not so sure that is true either anymore. And I think it's definitely, as authoritarianism rises around the world, we are seeing more and more evidence that it's dictators that benefit from innovations in tech. Many of these innovations coming, of course, from Silicon Valley.
Mm. Do you think it's a cycle? This time it's different? I'm thinking of the fact that, you know, whenever we have a new media, even from as far back as the printing press, but certainly radio and television, you see authoritarians rise and take advantage of that. And it takes a while for people to sort of learn how that works and push against it. So far, we've been able to push against it most of the time. Do you think this time is different?
I mean, it's a million-dollar question. Let me get my crystal ball. It's a question that lots of people are trying to figure out an answer for. I think it's a little bit of both. And of course, we've seen the moral panic has happened before. Mm-hmm. You know, the advent of radio was a really good example, right? We've all worried about these new platforms before. But I think what's happening to societies at large today is very different because it's happening at such massive scale. And also because the very foundation on which so many societies are built, which is like that kind of consensus around facts and truth, that seems to have eroded to a level that has not happened before. You know, we can't agree on very, very basic things. You know, white is white and black is black, and the world can be presented to you as completely upside down, and there will be people who will believe in it. And we've seen, you know, this rises of like new conspiracy theories, you know, whether it's anti-5G or QAnon or, you know, take your pick, there's so many. And of course, they've existed before, but they have never penetrated through societies with the effectiveness that they have in more recent years, just because of the sheer reach, right? Like, you find them everywhere. You find them on Reddit. You find them on Facebook. You find them. It's just everything spreads like wildfire. Adding to the problem is the fact, and that is a fixable fact, like that is something that can be fixed. But adding to this, you know, very fast spread is the fact that the infrastructure of the modern internet and social media platforms are built to spread the lies rather than facts, right? It's much easier for fake news to spread on social media, or for anything clickbaity, juicy, or fake to spread on social media than any quote unquote good information. So that doesn't help the problem.
Yeah, I think about it as sort of a one-way fan, if you will. It just accelerates the spread in one direction, and it doesn't do much to stop it going the other way.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. It's a good analogy.
When I was young, my uncle brought me a pamphlet about how President Carter was the Antichrist. The literal, you know, the pamphlet alleged that. And I always think back to that because that is exactly the kind of thing, the tenor of the thing that you're talking about that spreads on social media. And yet there was a break on him being able to do that. He could only show that to as many people as he could print copies and get to, you know. And I had a car. He didn't have to walk. But there was a limit to how far that would spread. And there was a slowness to it that allowed my dad to step in and go, yeah, my dad was a Republican, but he was like, don't pay too much attention to that stuff. It's the speed and the acceleration, I think, that makes it hard for people to deal with it in ways that they would have dealt with before. Do you see, when you're covering this, which I know you do very closely, do you see any efforts that seem hopeful or seem possible to kind of help put speed bumps in the way or help people to deal with it?
Before I answer that, I also want to add that it's not just the speed. Mm. It's also the fact that, you know, when you were young and you got that pamphlet, I think there was a lot more room for discussion and conversation mm-hmm. than there is today. Because if you think about how social media platforms are built and the way that they lock us more and more into our filter bubbles, I remember, for this podcast that we did for Undercurrents, Tech Tyrants and Us, we did a story about Thailand. You know, in Thailand, monarchy, the royal family has always been a massive taboo subject. And in this, so we did this like long story about what the role that Facebook plays in lives of regular citizens of Thailand. And we had a Thai academic who gave us this example of how during the big protests, when the whole country was divided between, I don't know if your listeners recall that, there were these big protests and there were, it's kind of the shorthand for them was the red shirts and yellow shirts. And, mm-hmm. you know, one camp supported the monarchy and the other camp supported the elected government. But that's the detail. The point was that this Thai woman whom we interviewed was saying that up until that point, you know, you could go on Facebook, even though you went to the protests and you were with your camp, you went on Facebook and you saw, you know, what people from the other camp were saying until the day when Facebook decided to change their algorithm. Mm. And the only thing that you could see on your timeline after that was the stuff that you engaged in. So if your cousin posted something that you didn't like and you didn't like it and you didn't share it, but you read it and it was interesting for you to hear your cousin's or your friend's or someone's point of view, you no longer saw that. And I think it's quite a scary thing of how, you know, and obviously it affected Thailand, but it affected so many other societies and corners of the world in ways that are almost impossible to measure, right? Because so much of the social discourse happens on social media today. And I think it's that locking groups up in these filter bubbles and making the conversation impossible, a debate, a discourse impossible is really, really dangerous. And now I've completely forgotten what the question was.
No, that leads right up to like, so what do you do? That was basically my question. Is there anything you see that says, but that won't hold forever? Here is a new situation. There's this startup called Artifact that's trying to do TikTok for news, but curate the sources. There's, you know, popularity of other types of platforms. I know you covered Be Real recently and some of the privacy concerns are around that. So is there anything you're seeing that says there's promise there to help people deal with all this?
First of all, I think we still lack the basic language to describe the problems that we have. Mm. We're still using really outdated language to talk about, you know, the new issues that are being brought up by this advances in tech and changes to information ecosystems that we live in. Mm. And it seems to me that increasingly the consensus is that if we were truly wanted to address it, we can't really address it without regulating. That we would never let broadcasters on air without regulating them. We would never let, you know, telecom companies, right? Like you regulate these mm-hmm. big companies that have an effect on the public discourse and on public life. And there is just, it makes no sense not to regulate platforms. And I think that's increasingly the consensus. I think we still don't fully understand the, we've come a long way, even a couple of years ago, I think, compared to our understanding of what tech was doing to society 2 years ago has advanced so much today. But I still think we're, it's a hard problem for people to fully grasp. We're still not completely understanding the extent to which tech and the way we use tech is changing the societies that we live in. And that was in a way, you know, our attempt was like, okay, can we find just like very, very human stories that really show how, you know, tech plays into a drama of living a life and like what happens with it. And I don't mean to be coming across as anti-tech. I'm not at all. And, you know, you wouldn't be able to have me give up on any of the wonders. Absolutely. But I think I think the urgency of addressing it is very real, because I think it is the human cost of neglect is a lot higher than we think.
I really like what you said about not having the language to discuss it. There's a whole vocabulary being built around this sort of thing. And what one person means sometimes varies than what another person means when just talking about social media and manipulation and facts and all of that. I tend to wonder, this is a theory, not a belief, if what's happening is we are having to untrain ourselves. And this is why I think those growing up with social media always in their life probably have a little more advantage on us. We're untraining ourselves to sort of a default belief that, you know, oh, if I see it in print, there's a certain amount of credibility behind it. Not 100%, but we're more willing to believe it because we read it. Even though we know intellectually that we shouldn't, there's just kind of a built-in habit from having grown up in a different era without the internet and without social media. And I say that because I have conversations with people and they'll say, yeah, I saw this thing on Twitter. I saw this thing on Facebook. I'm like, well, who said it? And they're like, well, I don't know, but it's all over the place. And it's like, yeah, but you're doing the thing you were just criticizing moments ago. Yeah. And so I think we're just, it's a habit that we need to unlearn.
That goes straight back to the word to the word you picked, which is manipulation. I mean, it is incredible to think about, you know, how easy in some ways it is to manipulate quite intelligent, you know, otherwise like absolutely intelligent people. How what little effort it takes. And, you know, I'm someone who follows very closely the war that is happening in Ukraine, and I follow very closely what's happening in Russia. And, you know, you can't find a better example of collective manipulation than what's happened and Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he has managed by using social media, but also traditional television and broadcast, he has managed to make the entire nation, or certainly the biggest part of the nation, believe that he's fighting a just war, mm-hmm. and that, you know, the West is about to bomb Moscow if they don't fight it, or that, you know, the Ukraine is full of neo-Nazis who, and so on. And, you know, I can go on listing the lies, but people genuinely believe that stuff because they've been exposed to it a lot. And that's where, you know, the reach of social media and the manipulation and the networks that some of the authoritarians have built using the social media is to spread quite, you know, uniform messages. It was extraordinary. For example, during COVID, we noticed in our newsroom very clearly how, you know, the messaging about COVID of Russian, Chinese and Iranian state news outlets was completely in sync. And you would get, and these are not just state outlets that are, you know, running their Facebook pages. No, this is also like a network of hundreds of thousands of people who are just picking it up. And in Chinese whispers, it just spreads, you know, across the internet, and it's repeated in how does the old saying go? A lie repeated in a thousand times becomes truth. And slowly all of that, you know, and the goal of that sort of manipulation and disinformation is not necessarily to convince you of one thing or the other. It's really just to undermine your belief in the truth. And once you take the truth away, there is no really shared value, like that collective consensus. And once you take the consensus away, then what happens to the society? So it's pretty scary stuff.
I feel like it's as big, if not bigger, of a win to get someone to stop caring what's true than it is to convince them that something is not true.
I would argue it's a bigger win.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah. So what do we do? I don't expect you to have the answer, or I think it would have been impossible to get you on this show because you'd be in such demand to help everybody fix it. But based on your experience and what you think, for a user of social media, what are signs that people can look for that maybe they're being manipulated, and what should they do about it? Do you just abandon platforms? Do you curate who you follow? Do you have any good advice for folks?
I think my advice is to be a bit of a journalist about it and look at everything with a little like healthy dose of skepticism and figure out where it comes from. I mean, very basic social media hygiene, actually, information hygiene, right? Check the sources, see if there are more than two sources on something. Don't repeat it. Don't retweet it. Don't share it unless you're sure that it's true, and figure out what's the agenda of whoever it is that's spreading a piece of information that you might be interested in. Not really, you know, not rocket science. It's basic stuff, but it's stuff that it requires a little bit of work. You know, it's a lot easier to scroll mindlessly through your timeline. I'm guilty as charged. I do that too. But when it comes to information, you know, it's funny. Sometimes my advice to a lot of people, sometimes all we need to do is to think, you know, to use the weapon that we have, our brain.
It sounds like work.
It is work. If you're not willing to do it, then you should be ready to be manipulated.
Yeah, I wish there was an easier answer, and I hope someday there will be. But I think you're right, and maybe if I were to boil it down, tell me if you think this is dangerous. You can read everything, but before you believe it, before you insert it into your mind, take a second look. Don't share anything before you're sure. And if you don't want to be sure, then just skip on past it. The danger there is that you're still being exposed to it, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's very little that we're going to be able to do about being exposed to it. And look, I mean, I have no answers to being exposed to it. I mean, again, I think some regulation of platforms is absolutely essential, and it has to happen. And the debate needs to take place. I think we need more coverage of the human cost of the lack of the regulation as well. I think we need to understand what actually happens. I think in the US, where a lot of this technology comes from, not anymore, you know, I mean, that was another truism that turned out to be, you know, completely not true, was the fact that, well, China would never catch up because they would never have the kind of creativity that they have in Silicon Valley. Well, everyone's on TikTok today, and guess what? You know, it's the Chinese. Yeah. So, and just the awareness, you know, I was just looking into a very popular health app that is what no one, and it's on, you know, it's on all of the major platforms. It's in all of the app stores, and it's on Google Play, it's on the Apple Store. You know, it does very well. It's run by an incredibly dodgy group of people out of Russia who are hoovering up data of millions of people around the world. What happens to that data? What are they going to do with it, you know? Because data is something that everyone wants these days. So I think we start, as with everything else in life, we start with awareness, and start with the awareness that the problem exists. And that's the first but a very important step.
Yeah, when you talk about rules and regulations, the one thing that I wish people talked about more is the idea that if Facebook, Meta, Alphabet, Google had their preference, and one of the reasons you see them preferring regulations, they would like those rules to be written in a way that keeps out competitors. And so it's not that you don't need the rules, but my preference is that the rules be written in a way that they will not preference the incumbent. And my head usually goes to rules that give you more control over your data. So don't say, well, a company has to spend all this money to safeguard the data, maybe fund a situation or a few situations like Solid that Tim Berners-Lee is developing, or something like that, that says you now control your data. And then these are rules about what they have to tell you when they ask for your data. I'm, I feel that is a better way to go than some of the rules I've seen where I'm like, you know, this isn't bad, but if I'm Facebook, it's easy for me to comply with because I've got billions of dollars. And it's not that I don't know that that solves the problem. What are some holes in that theory?
Yeah, no, I think more and more people are turning towards decentralized internet as the way of circumventing a lot of these issues and problems. And I think it has a very good chance of taking off. It's not as convenient, right? The power of Facebook, you know, like look at, you know, a lot of people have migrated to Mastodon once Elon Musk took over Twitter, but a lot of people are still finding it a little bit just mm-hmm. not quite as smooth and just not quite as easy. So the product has to be good, right? And it's hard to make a good product when, you know, you don't have as much kind of resources as the big guys. But I think there is definitely a tendency. I think there is also younger generations are just naturally more skeptical of the big tech and big platforms from what I'm seeing in general, whether that is something that they stick with as they get older or not is something that we'll need to wait and see. You know, there's a lot less interest in people sort of joining some of the old platforms. But you know, I think there's still so much that we don't know, right, about the platforms that are out. Like, what do we know about TikTok? What do we really know happens?
Yeah, we know more about TikTok than we do about even BeReal or something like that, simply because
that's right. And then there is that.
And there's many new things coming up. You know, how much do we really know about something like Hive or Post or any of those?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And keeping up with, especially for policymakers and regulators, is a real struggle. Mm-hmm.
I think one area of hope that I cling to is that these platforms are not forever. They seem forever. They seem, you know, unassailable because they are so huge. But, you know, everything is forever until the moment it is not. And, you know, the Berlin Wall being one of the greatest historical examples of that. Those are exceptions, not the rule. But Facebook, as you just pointed out, isn't convincing the younger audience to keep coming. So it's not like it's going to go away tomorrow, but its influence is starting to wane. It is starting to look a little more like Yahoo to me. And I feel like we could be in a situation where Facebook, by the time everybody regulates it, is no longer as relevant as it was when the process began.
Yeah, but it's also a question of what they are being replaced with, right? Mm-hmm. So if instead of Facebook with its opaque policies and rules and laws, we have TikTok with even more opaque policies and rules and laws and weird content management and monitoring system and so on, I mean, then like, is this really progress for, you know, people who are worried about the effect of tech on the quality of, you know, democratic debate in the society? Arguably not. I mean, ultimately, we haven't come up, none of these platforms offer a place where a fair debate can take place.
Yeah.
Right? None of them can kind of host a fair debate, and
the motivations aren't there for that.
They've got their business models, yeah, and they're making money, and a debate is not what's going to make them money. So it's a very tricky.
An argument makes them money. A debate does not make them money.
Correct. Right. Exactly.
That's why I go back to that idea of I think. Rules and regulations around platforms are as important, if not more important, than rules targeted at particular companies or sets of companies, because it addresses that future need of like, all right, let's do our best to prevent manipulation by any future platforms. At least that's my hope.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's not, it can't be about individual companies, or it has to be the combination of both. Mm-hmm. But it has to be about like reframing the way we think about that sort of manipulation of information, you know, and a lot of the reaction to this day is very, you know, I always think it's very reactive. Like, it's all about, like, there are all these people who talk about countering disinformation. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, counter fighting disinformation and fighting this and fighting that. And that's ultimately a very reactive, it puts you into a defensive position. So you're always following someone else's agenda, ultimately, right? So it's about creating this regulatory space in which you can restructure the way that the conversation takes place, rather than, you know, try to kind of fight back to the individual pieces of information or individual platforms or individual companies.
And going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, people need to think, they need to take time and look at what they're believing and what they're reading. You know, do you think there's a role for education, for teaching people literacy in how to avoid manipulation?
Oh, God, massively. I think so. And there are examples in the world that provide a really great pathway to it as well. I mean, in Scandinavia, media literacy classes start from, you know, age six. It's basic critical thinking, right? It's just giving kids a habit to think hard about the information that competes for their attention and whether it's worth it or not. Others have done it successfully. So it's not like you have to completely, you know, reinvent the wheel. And I think a lot of the answers are sadly not necessarily in journalism. That plays an important role and has to play a more, you know, a bigger role, I think. But I think a lot of the answers are in education and starting very early and then getting young people to think differently about the way that they consume information. And I think, you know, from what I am seeing, I think they are doing it a little bit themselves, almost as a, you know, way of protecting themselves.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I see a lot more kids tend to be quite wise about the information that they consume, sometimes a lot wiser than the grown-ups. But I think giving it a structure and making it a priority on a bigger level, I think would make a difference. Because this tsunami of information, you know, good, bad, whatever, the noise is not going to end, right? It may be Facebook today and something else tomorrow, but the tsunami is not going to go away.
Yeah.
Like that volume is not going to shrink. So we all need to figure out how to live constructively in the world that is very, very noisy, and how to talk to each other. Because essentially, I think what social media has done, instead of giving people a better platform for having a debate, it has taken away the public square, right? Mm-hmm. It has taken away that space where everyone could come out and be, you know, whether you're a king or, you know, or a king or a shopkeeper in that square, you have the equal voice and the equal right.
I wonder if TV did that first, and social networks and technology platforms have extended it. Sometimes I wonder if we're not ignoring the fact that TV is still massively popular and a massive propaganda machine. And not that we shouldn't be looking at the social network effect, but sometimes we look at it at the exclusion of this big engine that's still rolling along.
You know, I think I would not even say TV. I think it started with television. Mm. And then I think with the advances in the internet advances, it became all of the news industry in general. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is not so much television as it is. It's the idea of a 24-hour news cycle. That idea is it's bullshit. There is not enough news to fill a 24-hour news cycle. Maybe on a day like today, when there is a massive earthquake in Turkey, sure, and people need to be broadcasting constantly because, like, this is information that can save lives. There are exceptions for sure, but most of the time, 24-hour news channels or any. You know, news industry, because everything now, newspaper reporters also have to file constantly now as well, because they're also filling that same bottomless pit, right? And we live in this culture of like constant updates. It just doesn't, there's just not enough of it to fill mm-hmm. the, to fill the 24 hours. So what are we doing? Why are we doing that? Why are we not looking for stories that are important, that actually tell us something about the world that we live in, that can make a difference and have an impact? And instead we're, you know, put ourselves in front of microphones and cameras and basically regurgitate the same thing that everyone else has kind of heard, and, you know, entertain along the way so that more people tune in and have better looking presenters. So, or have, you know, like louder presenters mm-hmm. so that more people look at us, even though we are basically saying the same thing that everyone else is saying, or just putting another like bits of spin on it so that more attention comes to us. So yes, absolutely. I think the news industry as a whole, and I think increasingly I see a better, and, you know, I'm a little bit cautious of saying that because I come from the news culture and I have many, many colleagues and friends who work in news, and I think and do tremendous job and are absolutely, you know, amazing journalists and wonderful people. But I do increasingly see the difference between journalism, distinction between journalism and news. And I think it will become an increasingly important distinction.
I think that goes back to our media literacy, where we sort of focused on young folks. And as you said, they may be better at this already than the people teaching them. It's probably people my age and older that need the media literacy training to tell them. And I've told this to my father-in-law. That's entertainment that you're watching. That's not news. There is such a thing as news, but when you're watching those 24/7 channels that are pumping you up about that topic that you're, you know, really excited about, that's entertainment. And just be aware of that. You know, I tell them like, hey, enjoy yourself, watch it, whatever, but don't use it as news. Do you think that's a kind of message that needs to get out there more?
Yeah, but unless you offer people an alternative, they're not going to, they're telling them that is not going to help, is sure. it? And I think what provided an alternative to a lot of people for a long time were local news, you know, news that were tailored to you, to your interests, to your community, to things that you wanted to know.
Things
about.
You can have an impact on. Yeah.
The things that you can have an impact on and things that have impact on your life. And that is another kind of silent victim of, not such a silent victim, but totally a victim of technological advances and advertising, digital advertising and on and on and on, right? So the local news is dead, but we need alternatives to these things. And I think a lot of people are working on alternatives. I think there is a very, in the US especially, there is a really inspiring cohort of nonprofit newsrooms that are trying really hard to, you know, do journalism in public interest and curate, to serve very specific communities, whether these are geographical communities or whether they're thematic communities. Mm. You know, you might be very interested in prison reform so that, you know, you go and you read Marshall Project, or you might be really interested in global affairs, so you come and read Coda Story, right, and so on. So I think there is a very healthy movement happening there. But it's still, I mean, it's nothing compared to the kind of money that is being spent in tech. I mean, it's just like a drop in the ocean. So if there was more money put into public interest journalism to give people a real alternative, right, to somehow replace that whatever, create an equivalent, modern day equivalent of whatever that the role that local news served, I think that would, you know, that would be incredibly meaningful.
Yeah. And it's a question of where that money comes from too, and how that money gets there as well, right?
Well, absolutely. And for a long time, that money came from, a lot of that money came from the platforms themselves, mm-hmm. right? And then yeah. that raises question, well, should you be taking money from Google and Facebook?
What strings are attached to that money?
And what strings are attached? Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this has been fantastic. I always like to finish our conversations with a little word game, if you're up for that.
Okay. I'll try. I'm terrible at games of all sorts.
It's not hard. It's called this or that. I'm just going to present you two options, and you tell me which you'd pick why.
Sure.
We'll start easy. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Why?
I like the taste. Wakes me up in the morning.
Yeah. Tea is too soft. You need the bolder.
Yeah. I would say so. I mean, tea has its place in my life. I'm not completely disowning tea.
Yeah. These are false dichotomies. Don't worry.
Yes, I guessed.
Mastodon or Tumblr?
Oh, God. Neither.
Yes, neither is an option. You can always pick neither. Do you have a platform out there that you think is worth examining? Or is it like, yeah, they all have their issues?
Oh, I can't face another platform.
Yeah.
I feel it's like last thing I need in my life is another platform. I mean, we're on them, but yeah.
That's a necessary evil for you.
That's right.
Fast or slow zombies?
Let's see. Well, I guess if I'm having coffee, fast zombies.
Mm-hmm. Because you've got your fueled.
Yeah.
Good answer. Heathrow or Gatwick?
Heathrow.
Yeah. Really?
Better food, better shops, mm-hmm. better, nicer airport.
Yeah.
Better transportation. Definitely.
I used to think Gatwick just because it was easy to get out of, but then you spend more than 2 minutes a year. You're absolutely right. Savory or dessert crepes?
Savory.
Mm. Any particular kind?
Caviar.
Ah, nice. Yeah. Caviar's having a moment right now, too. Like, I see it everywhere.
When did caviar not have a moment?
But that's true. It never went away, but I feel like I've seen it even more often than not. Dogs or cats?
Oh, as a proud owner of both, I refuse to answer this question.
You could say both. Yeah. That is both. There's precedent even for people saying both on the show. So, do your dogs and cats get along?
It depends. There are three of them, one dog, two cats. Dog and one cat hate each other. Dog and the other cat have warmed up to each other. Mm-hmm. They don't love each other, but they just about. Dog came after cats, which always means, you know, tension.
Yeah.
If a kitten comes to the dog, they're accepted.
And I've had three dogs, one of whom loved cats, just was fascinated, thought they were the best thing ever, and the other two just want to chase them. So, yeah, kind of depends on the personality, too.
It depends.
News or journalism?
Did you just add that?
I did, yeah.
What do you think? Journalism, of course.
Of course. And then dry or humid?
Humid, actually. Mm. Humid.
Most people choose dry. That's interesting. Just you don't have to keep applying moisturizer or something.
Yeah, and I just I like kind of subtropical humidity, heat and humidity.
Yeah. All right. Well, Natalia, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it. Before we go, let folks know, remind them one more time where they can go to find your work and what's going on at Coda Story.
Sure. It's codastory.com. So please do visit and sign up to our newsletters, read the pieces. There's lots and lots on the website. Always tell us what you think. And if you want to check out the podcast that I mentioned, it's called Undercurrents, Tech Tyrants and Us. And that is actually on Audible. So if you head into your Audible app, you can just look it up. Undercurrents, Tech Tyrants and Us. And there too, we would love to know what you think.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Natalia.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to our producers, Jen Cutter, Roger Chang, and Anthony Lemos. Thank you for listening to this show and telling your friends about it. You can get an ad-free version of this show with Acast Plus. Click on Access Exclusive Content at awordpodcast.com. We'll have a word with you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.